Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Alex Ritson, and at 13 hours GMT on Thursday the 13th of June, these are our main stories. G7 leaders are in Italy for a summit at which they're likely to approve a plan to use frozen Russian assets to fund the defence of Ukraine. The EU's top court has ordered Hungary to pay a fine of more than $200 million for failing to comply with the bloc's migration policy. Also in this podcast, 1,000 days since the Taliban banned Afghan girls from attending high school, the UN says that systematic exclusion is harming their mental health. A BBC Arabic investigation has found that the warring parties in Sudan are using weapons provided by Iran and the United Arab Emirates, despite a UN arms embargo. And in the United States, a restaurant turns away adult diners if they're not old enough.
It's just something for the older people to come to and not have to worry about. Some of the young folks, they bring some of that drama.
Under sunny skies in Bari, the Italian Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni, fresh from her recent European election success, has been welcoming world leaders to a G7 summit. Migration is one of Italy's biggest concerns, particularly with thousands of people every year trying to get across the Mediterranean from Africa to Europe. Ms. Meloni is asking other nations to contribute financially to what's known as the MATE plan, which gives African countries grants and loans to develop their economies and green energy projects.
The message we want to convey is a G7 that, under the Italian presidency, wants to strengthen its dialogue with the nations of the global south. We've done this because this land is historically a bridge between West and East.
We'll hear more on the topic of migration shortly, but also high on the G7's agenda will be providing more help for Ukraine in its war with Russia. Western leaders are looking to raise $50 billion to help Kyiv defend itself against Moscow's full-scale invasion. With President Biden facing a tough election against Donald Trump and other leaders politically beleaguered at home, there's pressure to deliver military aid to Ukraine while they still can. Ahead of the summit, the NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg said he was hopeful the proposals would be approved.
I expect that today and tomorrow we will agree the plan for NATO security assistance and training for Ukraine. But of course, it remains work to do on the financial pledge. My proposal is that we should agree a long-term financial pledge with a baseline of $40 billion per year. That is new, fresh money every year delivered to Ukraine, because they need that to be sure that they have the resources to repel the Russian aggression against their country.
I asked our correspondent Mark Lowen, who's at the summit in Bari, more about the aid package for Ukraine.
I think it is the most likely deliverable, if you like, from this G7 summit. There have been various plans. One idea was actually to freeze and seize, indeed, Russia's assets in the West that are thought to be about $300 billion and liquidate them and use that for money for Ukraine. But that was supported by the US and yet opposed by other parties, including Christine Lagarde, the president of the European Central Bank, who thought that it would set a dangerous precedent in the international financial system and potentially violate international law. So then this new idea came out to basically take the interest on those Russian assets and front-load them, so basically kind of give from several years ahead interest, which they think would amount to about $50 billion in order to give to Ukraine. And the loan would be given against the assets used as collateral, basically. It would obviously be important for Ukraine at the moment, which is facing a renewed Russian advance in some parts in the east. It is running dangerously short of money and weapons, and so it needs everything that it can get. And that will be a very strong sign of support from the G7, as will a pledge of another $320 million that Rishi Sunak, the British Prime Minister, is likely to make to his Ukrainian counterpart, who will be a guest at the summit. And Joe Biden will be signing a treaty with President Zelensky, promising long-term security support for the country, even if he is booted out of the White House in November.
The summit being hosted by Giorgia Meloni, who is basking in the glory of the recent European election results.
Yeah, and she's really, you know, arguably the strongest leader going into this summit. I mean, leading a country that is notoriously politically volatile, that's known almost 70 governments since the Second World War, and yet she was the only Western European leader strengthened by these European Union elections last weekend. Emmanuel Macron of France has been floored by the far-right success there. Olaf Scholz delivered his party's worst ever European Union election results, beaten into third place by the far-right AfD. Rishi Sunak of the UK is languishing in the opinion polls. Joe Biden could be booted out of the White House by Donald Trump in November. And here you have Giorgia Meloni, who says, you know, we are the strongest government in the G7 now, and, you know, we are a pillar of stability in when our neighbours are losing their footing.
And, Mark, there are some other important matters on the agenda.
There are climate and a push for countries to move faster in their transition to renewable energy. Italy and Germany have been more reluctant to move further away from gas. There'll be a push for maybe a new treaty on global plastics pollution. There will be a session dedicated to artificial intelligence, which will be attended by none other than Pope Francis, who has called for more global regulation of AI. And there'll be a discussion on Africa as well, with Italy placing energy and infrastructure projects in Africa at the heart of its agenda and its presidency of the G7, hoping that more investment in Africa will encourage young Africans to stay on the continent rather than migrate, often illegally, to Europe.
Mark Lowen. The UN Refugee Agency says the number of people forced to leave their homes because of violence or persecution has risen for the 12th consecutive year to 120 million. The agency's head, Filippo Grandi, warned that world leaders were failing to tackle the root causes of displacement. Here's Imogen Folks.
New conflicts breaking out, old ones continuing, and millions fleeing the violence. In Sudan alone, 9 million people have been driven from their homes in little more than a year. Syria, a conflict many have forgotten, remains the world's largest displacement crisis, with 13.8 million people unable to go home. The UN Refugee Agency condemned the warring parties, saying blatant violations of international law were driving displacement and misery.
Imogen Folks. As we heard, Sudan in particular is a concern. 9 million people have been forced to flee from their homes during the 14-month conflict that has devastated it. Now, a BBC Arabic investigation has found evidence that despite a UN arms embargo, the warring parties in Sudan are using weapons provided by Iran and the UAE. Abdul Rahman Abu Taleb reports.
What you can hear is the rebel support forces celebrating after downing a drone used by their rivals, the Sudanese armed forces. Analysis of video footage by the peace organization PAX shows it to be Iranian-made. Wim Zwanenberg, humanitarian disarmament project leader for PAX.
We see that the SAF have provided more drones in the conflict because they're getting support from Iran. They're in a better position at the moment, so we already see that's having an impact.
Flight tracking and images show several Iranian planes landed in Port Sudan at the time these drones started to appear. Wim Zwanenberg one more time.
That indicates like active support to the SAF by Iran. And it means also Iran has to provide support in maintenance of these kind of drones.
The BBC has found evidence to support the UN's accusation that the UAE has been supplying the RSF with arms. The UAE and Sudan's Sovereignty Council have denied the allegations. The Sudanese army, the RSF, and the Iranian Foreign Ministry declined to comment. Providing external weapons support would be a violation of the 2005 UN Security Council resolution banning the supply of weapons to Sudan's Darfur region. Brian Kastner, Senior Crisis Advisor at Amnesty International.
The parties to the conflict in Sudan have really made a mockery of the embargo. The UN Security Council needs to fulfill its responsibility, see the massive internal displacement, see the number of civilians killed, and implement a comprehensive arms embargo across the entire country immediately.
Abdul Rahman Abu Taleb. A fine of $200 million has been imposed on Hungary by the European Court of Justice for failing to comply with the European Union's migration policy. And on top of that, There's a penalty of around $1 million a day until the Hungarian government makes the required policy changes. In 2020, the anti-immigrant government of Viktor Orban pushed through a law forcing asylum seekers to apply for travel permits at its embassies in Belgrade or Kyiv. At the time, the European Court of Justice ruled such practice to be in violation of EU laws. For more on this, I spoke to our correspondent in Budapest, Nick Thorpe.
This is a long story. The Hungarian government has been opposing migration really since the big wave of migration in 2015. It established transit zones, and this is what specifically this judgment refers to. Transit zones effectively are fenced areas built into its border fence with Serbia. It there did not, according to the court, give asylum seekers an opportunity, a proper opportunity to apply for asylum in Hungary, and then it pushed them back through the fence. So it was found guilty both of not giving the opportunity to apply for asylum, then of pushing them back, and then since then of not implementing the court's order, a previous court order from December 2020 on this.
And this has prompted absolute outrage from the Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban.
Mr. Orban indeed has said that this is outrageous and unacceptable, and he's certainly given the impression that Hungary doesn't intend to implement it. On the other hand, you know, it's hard to see what it can do now, in this situation. It's certainly the most serious of a series of court judges which have gone against the Hungarian government on this issue.
Yeah, what if Hungary refuses to pay?
I think that is the position of the Hungarian government at the moment, which will also argue that the EU migration rules are being overhauled, often influenced by Hungary's position, as other countries come round to the need to, as they see it, to follow Mr. Orban's logic of keeping people who try to cross into Europe illegally out. But, of course, the European Union can cut the money from other funds that the EU was intending to give to Hungary. Of course, even those are held up at the moment because of rule of law issues. So, in a way, there's a sort of logjam of cases against Hungary at the moment in this most serious one now on migration.
Nick Thorpe in Budapest. More than 300 years ago, in 1714, Britain established a prize worth £20,000 for anyone who could find a way of pinpointing a ship's longitude. Three centuries on, a new longitude prize was announced, now worth $10 million, with a focus on tackling the modern problem of superbugs. That competition has run for a decade, with more than 250 entries. And on Wednesday night, the winner was announced at the Science Museum here in London. The original work on the test was done by Swedish researchers, and it is now being sold by the company Sysmex Astrego. Our science correspondent James Gallagher was at the Science Museum.
This is a device that, instead of it taking up to 3 days to confirm whether an infection is caused by bacteria and what drugs might work against it, this is something that does it incredibly rapidly. So it only works in urinary tract infections at the moment, but there's a little cartridge and you put a little bit of urine inside it, and then that goes into the machine and it monitors how those bacteria in there might grow under the presence of different antibiotics. And so, within 15 minutes, it confirms whether or not you're actually dealing with a bacterial infection. And within 45 minutes, a little display lights up on the top of the device, and it tells you which is the best drug to use to treat that infection. So you're taking a process that takes 3 days down to less than an hour. In terms of how much it's going to be used for patients, comes down to what it always comes down to when we chat about these things, money and how affordable it is. So I can very easily see a world in not too distant future where in rich countries this becomes part of the routine process, where you have a patient that comes in, you don't know what's causing their infection, you do a test like this, it confirms the infection rapidly, and that patient leaves that doctor's surgery with the right treatments at the right time. But there will be many, many countries where antimicrobial resistance is a huge problem, where devices like this are still going to be too expensive for many years to come. One of the things that's on the horizon is, could you look at bloodstream infections as well? Could you take a sample of blood and basically perform a very similar analysis to work out what was going on there? But yeah, absolutely, the dream is to go from what at the moment is sometimes guessing what the right treatment is, and if that doesn't work, just moving on to the next treatment, to actually having the knowledge to be able to prescribe drugs in a much more informed way, which has two benefits. It stops the overuse of antibiotics when we don't need them, but at the same time, gets better treatment for patients.
Our health and science correspondent, James Gallagher. In the United States, it's not strange to see venues impose strict age restrictions on children and young adults under the legal drinking age of 21. However, a restaurant in Missouri has gone one step further, turning people away as old as 34. Ella Bicknell reports.
Lamb chops ready?
Delicious. Jamaican style.
Marvin and his wife Tina set up Bliss Restaurant in the southern St. Louis suburbs to bring the joy of their Caribbean resort holidays to their local community at a fraction of the cost. For them, maintaining that sophisticated environment meant a strict age limit for patrons. Driver licenses checked at the door, all women under the age of 30 and all men under 35 will be denied entry. Tina says they wanted it to have the right ambiance.
It's just something for the older people to come to and have a happy hour, come get some good food, and not have to worry about some of the young folks that bring some of that drama.
However, Marvin says not everyone has reacted well to the policy.
And of course, we have been getting a little backlash, but that's okay because we're sticking to our code.
Some online commentators have accused the restaurant of age discrimination, bombarding their site with one-star reviews, but others have taken to social media to support the move. One user said it created a very pleasant dining experience, and they'd even support an age limit to 40 and over. Others said the ban was an understandable response to St. Louis's historically high rates of antisocial behaviour. Legal concerns have been raised. However, in Missouri, the state's Human Rights Act bans discrimination only on the grounds of sex, race, religion, and disability. Eating establishments cannot impose age limits on staff, but those protections don't apply to its customers. And no doubt other restaurants will be watching closely to see if the age limit restrictions on patrons imposed by Bliss turn out to be a success.
Ella Bicknell. Still to come, how a caretaker in Kenya got more than he bargained for.
As I was returning, the dogs were barking very loudly. To my surprise, I saw a lioness running after one of the dogs towards one corner of the compound.
The United Nations Children's Agency says 1,000 days have passed since the Taliban banned girls in Afghanistan from attending secondary schools. UNICEF said the systematic exclusion of the youngsters was not only a blatant violation of their right to education, but it also resulted in their deteriorating mental health. I asked our South Asia regional editor, Anbarasan Etirajan, how many girls were affected.
This is the third academic year for the Afghan girls, those who want to go to secondary schools. And we are talking about nearly 1.5 million Afghan girls who are unable to go to their normal schools since the Taliban seized power in August 2021. On average, about 350,000 girls, they graduate from class 5 going into the secondary schools. But now the issue is more and more girls are staying at home. Even though they have the opportunity to go to Islamic religious schools, many parents, they don't want to send them there because they only teach religious subjects. And this is what UNICEF is saying. It is not simply about denying them opportunities. It is also having a huge impact on their mental health. Imagine if you're sitting at home wanting to study, wanting to go to school, but then the rules doesn't allow you. You will be punished if you try to learn something. And that is why the UN says that every additional day, more dreams die.
And the effect on girls and young women is life-changing in the most awful way, isn't it?
You know, many young women from Afghanistan, they want to become artists, doctors, poets and engineers. And what are the opportunities? Education is not simply about career for Afghans. And what the UN and other agencies say, it will teach them life-saving skills. And in a society like in South Asia, where if a young girl is 16, 17 at home, the priority for the parents would be to get them married. So at least if they go to school, they can think about university. As you know, Taliban also banned women from starting universities, going to universities in December 2022. And also malnutrition, also how to prevent them from any big disasters, how to advise their village community people. So these were the opportunities the girls can have that has been denied. And now the Taliban rulers, they keep on saying that a suitable environment has to be created to open these schools. But then 3 academic years have passed. People are waiting for them to take a decision on that. And in the meanwhile, when, you know, there are so many sanctions against Taliban, restrictions, 4 of the leaders, they were allowed to go to Saudi Arabia to perform the Hajj to Mecca. And what the analysts and the civil society activists have been saying, unless you put pressure on Taliban, they are not going to change their policies towards women.
Anbarasan Etarajan. It's 3 weeks until the British general election, and today the main opposition party, Labour, has presented its manifesto, its plans, if elected as the next government. The economy is a central objective, and Labour's leader, Sir Keir Starmer, has told voters they have the chance to turn the page on 14 years of what he called Conservative chaos. The Labour leader said he was seeking a mandate for economic growth, with wealth creation his number one priority. Since the last general election, won by the Conservative Party 5 years ago, the economy has barely grown. So how are voters and businesses feeling, and can anything be done? Our political correspondent Rob Watson reports.
Since the last general election in 2019, there's been a fall or stagnation of real incomes on a scale unprecedented in the last 60 years. One visible sign of that, food banks, even here in prosperous Epsom, just south of London.
Hi, I'm Bex. I'm the pantry manager here for Good Company. We have lots of fresh fruit and veg, dairy products, meat, things like that.
Morning.
People's income is just not matching their outgoings at the minute, and people aren't able to make ends meet.
When the Conservatives first came to power in 2010, just over 60,000 people used food banks. Now it's nearly 3 million. I'm going to have a quick word with one of the clients here, a woman who I understand works for Britain's National Health Service.
I earn a good salary and so does my partner, but, you know, you're not benefiting really from it.
People would be amazed, wouldn't they, sort of listening around the world. You have a good salary, your partner, you work in the health system, but still it's hard to make ends meet.
We rent, and we're a family of 5, and we have had to move into basically a 2-bedroom, but one of them's a box room. So we then have to sleep on the sofa, because we cannot afford a 3-bed in this area. It's too expensive.
But it's not just individuals and families feeling the squeeze. Business does too.
Mark Brearley, I'm proprietor of K-Met, and we're in our factory making tea trays and trolleys that we sell around the world.
Businesses here in Britain and around the world have been affected by the war in Ukraine, by COVID. Businesses in Britain like yours have been affected by Brexit as well.
Well, yeah, it's really frustrating. It's a big wound to businesses like ours. It's a wound that keeps on bleeding. It's just got a lot more difficult to get our stuff over to Europe. It's slower, it's more expensive. It's a giant pain in the neck.
Businesses and individuals alike are all agreed what Britain really needs is stronger economic growth. So I'm now leaving the K-Met factory here in South London to see leading economist Paul Johnson, director of the Institute for Fiscal Studies, to find out whether either of the main parties has a credible plan for getting Britain growing again.
Not obviously, no. It's worth saying that the UK is by no means the only country whose growth has slowed a lot since the financial crisis. Ours has slowed more than many others. Well, we have had some ideas from Labour. They want to liberalise our appallingly sclerotic and expensive planning system. The Conservatives are more focused on trying to find space for some more tax cuts over the coming period. And we're not getting a deep discussion of any of those.
And Paul, you and actually pretty much every economist in this country has said that during the general election campaign, the politicians aren't being honest with the voters. What do you mean by that?
What I mean is that we're not being told what's actually likely to happen in terms of tax and spending over the next few years. To get debt falling by the end of the parliament, we are going to have to either increase taxes beyond where they are at the moment, and they're already at a historic high in UK standards, or cut spending across a range of public services. But neither party is seriously addressing those choices.
So whoever wins the election will inherit a challenge. Britain's national debt is high, growth forecasts are low, its public services under pressure from an ageing and ailing population. Perhaps whoever wins can draw some comfort from polling, which suggests voters' expectations are low.
Rob Watson. Now to Kenya, where residents in a suburb of the capital, Nairobi, are on high alert following a series of sightings of lions in their neighbourhood. The homes border the Nairobi National Park, and officials say one reason for the increase in sightings is due to recent torrential floods, which killed hundreds of people and forced the animals to move from their usual grazing areas. Here is caretaker Joshua A. Sigi describing an incident of a family compound that he was taking care of last month.
I had just stepped out of the house walking towards the toilet. As I was returning, the dogs were barking very loudly. I turned to see what was happening. To my surprise, I saw a lioness running after one of the dogs towards one corner of the compound. It got hold of the dog, pressing it down. I hit iron sheets, hoping the noise will scare the lioness so that it can let go of the dog. But unfortunately, it already had the poor pet firmly in its jaws. Then it ran towards the gate, jumped over and went away.
The BBC's Peter Musembi caught up with Sylvia Kwera, the college student whose family dog was taken and eaten by the lioness 3 weeks ago.
We are constantly in fear because we don't know if it will come again, and we just don't want to experience another loss. We even have a trap. They set it up for the lioness in case it comes back. Looks like a cage, but it has two sides. There's the bait side and then there's the trap side. Both sides are separated with a steel mesh so that when the lion enters, it cannot eat the bait. They put a dog, a stray dog.
Take me back to that night when this lioness jumped over the gate into your compound.
It was around 10 p.m. We just heard a cry sound of a dog, but we assumed that it was just something else. But when the caretaker came in to tell us that he's seen a lioness in our compound, that's when we went out to look. Then we were looking for our dog, Jesse. We couldn't find it. That's when we called my mother for her to check the CCTV camera. Then she told us that there was a lioness and it has taken our dog. It could have been more fatal because the caretaker is the one who saw it. He was lucky because it could have been him. It could have been anyone, even a child.
Sylvia Kwera speaking to Peter Musembi. And to hear a longer version of that episode, just search for BBC Africa Daily wherever you get your podcasts. The ancient Maya city of Chichen Itza in Mexico has long been associated with human sacrifice, with hundreds of bones unearthed from temples, a sacred sinkhole and other underground caverns. It has long been thought that the victims were often young and female, but analysis of DNA of human remains has revealed something different, as James Reed reports.
The children were thrown into an underground water cistern in Mexico's Yucatan Peninsula as an offering to the gods more than 1,000 years ago, part of a well-documented Maya practice of human sacrifice. Now, DNA extracted from 64 of them has shown that they were all boys. Some were brothers, and there were two sets of identical twins. Previous research and Spanish colonial accounts suggested the Maya favoured girls as sacrificial victims. The researchers think the boys may have been specifically selected as sibling pairs for sacrifice. Twins were regarded as auspicious in Maya cosmology, and subterranean waterways were seen as gateways to the land of the dead. Chichen Itza, with its mighty pyramids, was one of many great cities that rose and fell in the centuries before the Spanish conquest brought Maya civilization crashing down. But the study also found strong genetic continuity with the indigenous Maya who live in the area today. And their language and culture remain rooted in the traditions of their ancestors.
James Reed. The Canadian singer Celine Dion was forced to cancel her last tour due to an autoimmune disorder called stiff person syndrome, which causes painful spasms. Now, she's made a documentary about her diagnosis and how she struggled to perform when she didn't know what was wrong. The BBC's Emma Vardy travelled to Las Vegas to meet her.
Celine Dion's voice is her instrument, and vocal exercises are vital. To audiences, she's one of the world's most powerful singers. But she revealed that for years behind the scenes, she was experiencing symptoms that went unrecognised and was struggling to keep up with her demanding performances. A diagnosis finally brought answers when she was told she was suffering from a condition that causes muscles to spasm, known as stiff person syndrome. She's only been seen rarely since announcing she'd be stepping back from performing. Now, in a new documentary, she explains how she's being rehabilitated and is now planning a new show in Las Vegas.
Because I'm back. I'll be on stage. I don't know when exactly, but trust me, I will scream it out loud.
Celine Dion is working with doctors to help learn more about her condition, which can be managed with medication and physical therapy. It's only found in around 1 in a million people, and Celine says she hopes to be part of finding a cure. Her previous residencies in Las Vegas, across 16 years, have been the best-selling of all time, and she says she's determined to return to performing here again.
Emma Vardy with that report. To Australia now, which has one of the highest rates of pet ownership in the world. Australians are now spending more than $20 billion a year on their pets. It's a huge industry that has grown rapidly since the pandemic. In response, Virgin Australia plans to allow dogs and cats to travel with their owners in aircraft cabins this year after rolling out the service in the US. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Ready? Come through. Yes, good boy.
Many businesses know a trick or two about making money from dogs. From daycare to vets and grooming, Australia's pet industry, that grew rapidly during the COVID pandemic, is worth billions of dollars. Across Australia, there are more pets than people. The bond Australians have with their pets is strong, despite economic uncertainty. But many animals are abandoned or taken to shelters. The Gigi Rescue Cat Cafe in Sydney offers the unwanted a second chance.
I don't say that it is cheap and easy to have cats or dogs. First of all, it is 20 years commitment. It's not just a birthday present. The cost of having pets is not cheap. If they got sick, even just an easy consultation costs a lot.
There are physical and psychological benefits of having a furry friend. It's sociable and you get plenty of exercise. There is a significant economic dividend. It's estimated that each year Australians spend about $22 billion on their pets that include fish, birds and snakes.
But cost of living pressures have left their mark and many pet owners are cutting back where they can.
What I've noticed since the third or fourth increase in interest rates, people are taking a lot longer to come to the grooming table. So whereas before they might have come every 6 weeks, they're probably now coming every 8 or 10. There's definitely a bit of a pinch.
Despite the challenges, however, working with dogs has its rewards.
You get to hang around with people like dogs like Bonnie, which gives a bit of a challenge. But, it's a great lifestyle.
And it's a lifestyle that one airline wants to get on board with. Virgin Australia has plans to become the country's first airline to let small cats and dogs fly in the cabin on some domestic flights. Australia's love of pets is to hit new heights.
Phil Mercer in Sydney. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was produced by Alice Adderley and mixed by Jack Wilfen. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Alex Ritson. Until next time, goodbye. Thank you.